And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara Counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is communicating. All of my guests are talking about communicating in one form or another. My first guest explained how and why stories make us better communicators from his book, Tell to Win. We discuss the hidden power of stories. My second guest is the best-selling fiction author, Jeffrey Deaver. We shared how he has become the next James Bond. He's going to take over writing the James Bond series of books from the Ian Fleming Foundation. My next guest is a lawyer, an author, an educator. He's best known for developing the net neutrality theory about the internet. He is the chair of the media reform group at Free Press, and we're going to be discussing his latest book, The Master Switch. As always, if you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Tim Wu is an author, a policy advocate, and the author of the book, The Master Switch. He's a professor at Columbia Law School. He's also chairman of the media reform organization, Free Press. Tim was recognized in 2006 as one of the 50 leaders in science and technology by Scientific American magazine. And then in 2007, Tim was listed as one of Harvard's 100 most influential graduates by the magazine 20138. Tim's best known work is the development of the net neutrality theory, but he's also written about copyright, international trade, and the study of law breaking. He previously worked for Riverstone Networks in the telecommunications industry. He's written for The New Yorker, The Washington Post, Forbes, Slate magazine, among others. Welcome to the show, Tim. How are you today?
Great. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it is a pleasure to be here. Now, you also have some breaking news for us as well that was not included in the introduction. I want to make sure we get that out right at the top here.
Sure. I guess I haven't put this somewhere in my – I haven't updated my bio. I'm actually working at the federal government right now for the Federal Trade Commission in Washington.
Ah, well.
And, I am on leave from Columbia at the moment, so that's a bit of a change. And I should say just at the beginning that what I'm talking, I'm not speaking here as the representative of the FTC, but as the representative of myself.
All right. Well, and I'm glad we got that out of the way, because now that I know you work for the FTC, I'll be sure not to use those seven deadly words that we can't use on the radio. So let's start at the beginning, and I think this is a funny story, because you're on record as saying that you got interested in writing The Master Switch because you saw I Love Lucy. Now, what was it about I Love Lucy that prompted you to do research and writing on the whole theory behind the Master Switch?
Well, it just astonished me. What I was actually looking at was the ratings for I Love Lucy. And it astonished me, I think it was the year 1957, that the ratings for I Love Lucy were something like 70% of Americans are up or watching the show. And so you had dozens of millions of Americans watching a single sitcom. And it just seems, I mean, there's popular shows now and then, but you just don't have anything near like those kind of audiences all tuned to one thing. And it, I mean, we know this if you've grown up in our century, how much things have changed. But I just became fascinated by the idea that this whole idea of a mass media was maybe just kind of a blip, was not something we just look back at, but a strange moment in human history. That in fact, in the 19th century, nobody would be capable, you know, there's no technology for everyone to see the same thing, and now we're kind of back to that. So that got me started on this idea that maybe there's some grand historical patterns that might be interesting.
Well, in fact, you did discover some recurring patterns that you see in the media based on all of this research. And if I can just paraphrase, I'm going to ask you to elaborate on this. Media moves from being open and being very, very innovative, moving more towards being monopoly and consolidation in the industry. Now, give us some examples of that, because the history is replete with examples.
Yeah, absolutely. This is really what the book, The Master Switch, is about, is tracing these cycles. You tend to have in the communications industry, which we're the theme of the show today, an alternation between, as you said, very open and very closed periods. I'll give you one example. Radio is a classic example. In the 1920s, there were thousands of independent radio stations, hundreds, maybe up to 1,000 all over the country. Many of them sort of amateur operations, some larger. And into the 1930s, the industry became much, much more consolidated, particularly with the rise of national broadcasting company, NBC, and the idea of chain networking, which we now call networks. So, you know, there's this enormous shift from a very open to a very closed industry. Now, there's another example. The telephone industry, began in the 1910s. There were hundreds of independent phone companies, maybe 1,000. And by 1921, there was one company, AT&T, that was the monopolist. So you see this tendency, the same thing in film in the 20s. Becomes integrated in the Hollywood system. So you see this tendency of the alteration. And the book isn't so much to condemn the closed periods or to celebrate the open periods. It's a little bit that. But to notice this grand historical pattern.
Well, and it's very interesting. And your book is just filled with fun stories. Since we're on the subject of the telephone industry and AT&T in particular, tell the story for my listeners, if you will, about the AT&T memorandum that came out, worried about what the telephone was actually being used for in about the year 1920.
In the 30s.
30, sorry.
But yeah, this was a reaction. There was an engineer inside Bell Labs who'd invented very advanced machine. It was the only machine of its kind in the world, and it was an answering machine. And inside of that machine was a tape recording device, which was also a new technology. There was some similar, but nothing quite as good as the tape recorder that AT&T had invented. But the management started to look at this and decided that this was an enormous threat, that the tape recorder was a threat to the telephone. And that, in fact, they should shut down this line of research. And their logic was really interesting. If you look back, like, why, you know, what's wrong with the tape recorder? You know, you don't really think of that as a threat. Well, they looked at it and then they said, well, if people use this tape recorder thing, they're going to record telephone conversations. And for one thing, that'll make businessmen very nervous to use the telephone because they'll think, well, you know, later on, when they're trying to negotiate something, well, in a legal case, someone will bring up a tape recording and ruin something. That's actually happened sometimes. But more seriously, to answer your question, or more darkly, they said, we estimate that some enormous quantity of telephone conversations are actually obscene. That the reason people are using the telephone is to have indecent conversations on intimate matters. And given the tape recorder, well, immediately that's going to stop and people will abandon the telephone. So AT&T was very concerned about the threat of the tape recorder to the telephone, and it's a good example of how a monopolist, once they're in power, often is less interested or sometimes interested in kind of controlling the next disruptive innovation.
All right, and it also shows the pervasiveness in porn when it comes to technology as well. We're talking to Tim Wu, his book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of the Media Empires. So, Tim, if this historical pattern is true, and I do believe that it is true, where companies move, industries and technologies move from openness to centralization, it begs the question, what leads the transition from openness to centralization? Is it some sort of government mandate? Is some authoritarian takeover? What exactly causes this?
Well, if you study the history carefully, it's a number of things that lead in that direction, some of which have more to do with government and some which are in a sense more natural. Typically, the open periods, what's very nice about them is there's a lot of diversity and a lot of creativity, but often there's a certain level of chaos as well and insecurity. The product is often quite unreliable. And so in some sense, there's a degree to which consumers start to demand something higher quality, in a sense. There's typically, in all these histories, also some fellow, some man who makes it his goal to in a sense, build himself an empire. And he sees a demand for higher quality products or security. He promises the nation that he will come along and give them something better. In the 1910s, when AT&T was really getting big, the president said, we will build the world's greatest network. It will be reliable. It will be perfect. It will be controlled by us, and it will be a monopoly, and you should, you know, competition's just a waste. You should forget about this. NBC promised better shows, higher quality Hollywood studios, better films. And so there's a sort of a mixture of a consumer demand for something a little more centralized and then also a person who delivers it. Sometimes government helps out. The government gets convinced that that's right. In the case of AT&T, they helped AT&T by banning competition in telephones, which was a huge aid to AT&T eventually. And so there are these turning points. And the real, one of the real questions, and I'm going to preempt your questions, is whether that's happening in today with the Internet, whether...
Exactly where I was going, Tim.
Exactly where you're going. Well, maybe I'll just let you ask the question.
Well, no, you've asked and answered it, so let's go ahead with it. You know, is the Internet different here? I mean, are we going to follow the same pattern? Or has some sort of a, if I can use the word, digital switch been flipped here?
Yeah, that's. I think that is the question of our times. Well, first of all, I'll point out that the strategies I just suggested, sort of a great mogul, sort of a great man of history, wield a power figure, arising and promising consumers something new and better and more controlled and safer, has been a pattern in history. And if you look today, you see much of the same thing happening. I'll allude, and again, these are my own comments, not governments, but if you look at a man like Steve Jobs, you can see that his strategies are very similar to those employed by early Hollywood or AT&T in the sense that, you know, he has this miraculous device, the iPad and the iPhones, and they're beautiful. I have several myself, or I have one of each, and they offer, you know, just kind of no problems, no hassle, and none of this kind of craziness that the Internet has been. And I think it's a very similar pattern. Now, the question is whether the Internet is going to be different. Also, Google, I always say, is also similar. Google, in some ways, reminds me of AT&T in the 1910s. They have obviously enormous power in the search engine, and they've promised to be good, and people generally trust Google, I think. I mean, some people don't, but most people do. And they're in this position where their public trust is sort of what they're banking on to allow tolerance of their dominance, monopoly, in fact.
All right. Well, now, here's some thoughts for you, and I'm just going to throw them out there. Some reasons that I see for this not happening is that the Internet, the genie's out of the bottle there. I mean, the Internet is different than a closed-loop system like AT&T's telephone system because it's built on open standards, and it truly is revolutionary. And in my opinion, it's probably too powerful to get rolled back at this point. You can't put the genie back in the bottle, can you, Tim?
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. One of the chapters in the book talks about the invention of the Internet and just how radical it was, what a difference it was. I'll add to that comment. There's an idea that, well, no monopolist could survive today because not only will the Internet ultimately upend them, but you also have a different kind of financing. You have venture capitalists who are always trying to fund the next monopolist, Facebook or whatever. So, it's just the genie's out of the bottle. Your theory is... Exactly right. I'm not sure. I really honestly don't know the answer to that question. But I do think there are certain things that don't change. Among them are the laws of economics and, more profoundly, the laws of human nature. America, for most of its history, has had monopolists or oligopolists in charge of communication, whether it's Hollywood, AT&T, or whatever. And that's the rule. The exception have been the last 20 years or so. At least historically. And I think that there are powerful economic forces that do lead in the direction of single companies. The sort of lock-in effects. I don't know if anyone of your listeners doesn't use Google, but it's kind of hard not to use Google, frankly. They've almost become essential.
Yes, they are.
You stop using them or try not using Facebook. You can totally opt out, but if you're on there, you're on Facebook or nothing else, you know. It's very rare to... It's very hard to try and do it. So those forces are still around.
All right. We're talking to Tim Wu, author of the book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Media Empires. Tim, I'd add to that culturally, we as citizens in the United States no longer want to see large monopoly companies. I mean, there was a period in time where bigger was better. What was good for General Motors was good for the company. But I think that died in the 1970s. Certainly it died by the 1980s with President Ronald Reagan. And we started to see the breakup in 84 of Ma Bell into the splinter groups that it had become at that point. So I'd say that it's against our human nature at this point as Americans to want that. But let me just shotgun, Tim, if I can, a couple of other companies at you and ask you your thoughts and how they fit into your theory. We've talked about Google, and that's great. But even before there was Google, there was AOL. So if your theory is, it's loose and fragmented and then it gets consolidated, AOL tried to do that, and in my opinion, AOL failed. So talk to me about AOL and where that fits into your theory.
Yeah, no, it does. We have a chapter on an AOL Time Warner merger, and it was an utter failure, and it was a demonstration of exactly what you're talking about, is the power of the Internet to resist monopoly. So I'll take the other side for a minute and say that there is strong evidence that the Internet And AOL tried, well, I mean, AOL had, there was a number of reasons that AOL failed. I think fundamentally, AOL and Time Warner didn't understand the internet well. They had the sense that, you know, they were the internet, and they didn't realize completely they had no control over companies like Google or Yahoo that would soon come to supplant them. So I think they made a grand mistake. Maybe it was a good idea for AOL. I want to get back to what you just said about, you know, worshipping size.
Okay.
I agree that that has changed. In the 20s, I read all the history, and there's this idea that bigger is progress, you know, that science always favors bigness. I think since the 70s, I think really the 70s are crucial. The small is beautiful movement, you know, Jane Jacobs, the whole idea of shopping locally, all these ideas that are still quite powerful today are different. Yet we say that, yet all of us use Google. So, you know, I mean, we say all that, but we have Google, we have Microsoft, Apple is in iPads is dominant. Americans are very conflicted. Americans love local, but then when a monopolist is more convenient, they switch in a minute.
You know? There you go.
And it takes a real kind of fortitude not to do that.
Well, we're talking to Tim Wu, everybody, author of the book, The Master Switch. Tim, I'm going to shotgun two more things at you.
Sure.
The next one is Wikipedia.
Mm.
How does that fit into your
Wikipedia
theory?
Wikipedia is fascinating. Wikipedia is sort of my model of if you're going to have a monopolist, what they should be like. In the world of online encyclopedias, they are the dominant. There's no question. There's no real competitor. And their being one is quite efficient. But they're very benevolent, likable. some of the editors get a little irritating sometimes, but it's an incredible project. And I think it's sort of what we should aim for if we're going to have a monopolist. If there's some markets that are just going to be monopoly no matter what you do, let them be like Wikipedia, open, you know, more or less democratically ruled, as opposed to being like AT&T in the old days, which is, you know, run by a cabal, run by one company trying to maximize profit.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, Tim, let me shotgun one more at you. And this one's a little bit harder, so I know you're going to be on your toes for it. And this isn't a company, but it's more of the underlying strategy behind the Internet, and that is TCP/IP.
TCP/IP.
Is a virtual monopoly on how we can travel over the Internet.
Yes, but also, again, very similar to Wikipedia. If there is going to be a universal monopoly, let it be unowned and let it be universal. It belongs to nobody. It's just a standard, like the English language. And I think it's important as a society we make sure some of the most crucial things are unowned, frankly, like the air we breathe or like the English language. It's very important that we make the right things be unowned. I think our world would be a lot worse if some company owned TCP/IP, and I think it's fabulous that it doesn't. It's credit to the engineers of the 60s and the 70s.
All right, Tim Wu. We're talking about your book, The Master Switch. I guess in the final analysis, in the end, what can be done? Are there modes of resistance against monopolies as you see them developing on the in all media that you've tracked over your historical research? And are these modes of resistance worthwhile?
Yes, they are absolutely worthwhile. I mean, I think we were a much more subservient people in the early 20th century in some ways. We just said, okay, well, you know, this company runs that company runs this. You know, we demand more Wikipedia-like things or TCP/IP-like things. It makes a difference, number one. Number two, I think that people do need to, when it's possible, occasionally not always just do the most convenient thing. And it's kind of like not always going to Starbucks. Occasionally, I'm serious. And people have very little feeling for that in their information world. You know, they'll always go to, some people do, but, you know, sort of, well, I use Google because it's always there. And Google is great, and I do use it, but I think we have to have an awareness of alternatives and awareness of the monopolies that we are building with our own choices.
Very good. We're talking to Tim Wu, everybody, author of the book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Media Empires. Tim, if people are fascinated, as I was, by what you have to say and the sound of your voice, they want to learn more about you, learn more about your book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
My website, timwu.org, has a bunch of things, and I recommend reading the book. It might get people more interested in this topic. Finally, Free Press's website, the group I used to chair. I'm the former chair now. If you Google Free Press, you'll find a lot.
Great, Tim. It has been a real delight. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you, Billy the Brain. It's been an honor.
Thank you. Take care now.